Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, gas prices are rising and there's no end in sight. As winter arrives in the Northern Hemisphere, Europe's gas shortage could cost the world a lot more to keep warm. Also this week, the rise of cryptocurrency in emerging markets. Despite banning trading in Nigeria, usage is rising, so Abuja plans to roll out its own e-currency. And thousands of illegal miners descended on this Andean mountain parish in Ecuador in search of gold. They left behind a trail of irreversible environmental damage. Now the community is fighting against a copper miner backed by the government. There is a little corner of the energy market that gets very little coverage. But after a cold winter in Europe last year, the continent has failed to fill its gas storage tanks for the next 6 months. Now, that failure has sent gas prices surging, and there's very little evidence that there's supply to meet demand this winter. It's not just a problem for Europe. The rest of the world could go without as rich countries corner the market in a similar way to vaccines. This year alone, New York natural gas futures are up 106% to a high of $5.20 per 1 million British thermal units. It's highest in more than 7 years. But the equivalent gas in Europe and Asian markets costs $25 per 1 million British thermal units. Storage sites are less than 72% full. That's the lowest in a decade. Well, the knock-on effects are huge. CF Industries Holdings, one of the world's biggest fertilizer groups, has been forced to close two plants in the UK, sparking fears of a looming shortage of ammonium nitrate that could hit food supplies. And a shortage of carbon dioxide production could hit the meat-to-soft drinks industry. Well, gas is also used to power electricity generation. Unsurprisingly, prices are soaring in that market too. Several energy suppliers have already collapsed in the UK. Governments across Europe are preparing to hand out money to households to cover the higher winter energy bills. Still, consumer groups are warning that the most vulnerable could be hit with fuel poverty this winter. According to European think tank Bruegel, a doubling of wholesale electricity prices from about €50 per megawatt hour to €100 would imply that the EU consumers pay up to €150 billion more for their electricity, and that's adding to inflationary pressures in the eurozone. According to Capital Economics, since the beginning of the year, the rise of gas and electricity has added half a percentage point to headline inflation. Well, some of the blame for the gas shortfall in Europe has been put on Russia. It's sending less gas via its pipeline through Ukraine. But Russia could open its new controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. The pipeline connecting Russia to Germany has been opposed by the United States, but German regulators have said it could take 4 months to certify the recently completed project. Well, to discuss all of this, let's bring in Simone Tagliapietra, a senior fellow at the Bruegel think tank, where he researches EU climate and energy policy. He joins us now via Skype from Rome. Simone, good to have you with us. So what's behind this rise in gas prices then? How much of this has to do with Europe failing to fill up its gas reserves?
Thank you. Well, Europe today finds itself in a perfect storm as far as natural gas market is concerned. All what could go wrong over the last months went wrong. On the demand side, we had a very cold winter, which pushed up the residential heating demand for gas. At the same time, we had an economic recovery, of course, in Europe, and therefore the industrial demand for gas went higher. At the same time, gas was also more and more requested for electricity generation as a result of two things. On the one hand, CO2 price in Europe went up, favoring a coal-to-gas switch. And at the same time, the output of wind was particularly low due to a very poor windy season. All these increased demand in Europe, and at the same time, we have problems on the supply because the European domestic production is decreasing. Norway has had some problems, and Russia is not sending all the molecules Europe would actually need. As a result of this situation, the storages levels in Europe are lower than usual in this period of the year, ahead of the new winter season. And this is what is of concern for analysts and traders because people now expect a potential gas crunch in the winter should temperatures be very low.
You're also arguing that the way in which the European gas market is structured is also at fault here. Why is that?
Well, over the last years, the European gas market has become more modern, let's say. It moved from a traditional structure of oil indexation in gas contracts to a spot market. 80% of the European gas today is traded on hubs, is spot market. This is, of course, giving great flexibility to the market, is a good thing, but in this particular condition, it's further adding pressure on the situation because Europe is not alone in the world. Asia is demanding a lot of LNG as the economic recovery is also happening in Asia, and therefore Europe has to pay more and more for the gas it wants to get. And certain suppliers, like Russia, for example, talk about their willingness of favoring Asian markets, given that the prices there are even higher than in Europe.
All right, so if Nord Stream 2 were to come online anytime soon, would that help alleviate the problem?
That's the geopolitical point, because all this situation happens at a time in which Nord Stream 2 has been built, and Russia is waiting for the certifications to start using it. The Kremlin said that should Nord Stream 2 be allowed to operate immediately, the gas prices in Europe will go down. This is paving the way for reflections about whether Russia is using the current situation to foster the case for a quick entry into operation of Nord Stream 2. So the question is Russia using this situation in a geopolitical manner in order to remember Europe that gas is important, that Russian gas is important, and Nord Stream 2 is important? This seems to be the case. And as a matter of fact, earlier this week, the International Energy Agency made a statement in which it clearly said that Russia can do more to supply Europe through the existing operating pipelines, which, by the way, Russia is not booking at the capacity many expected to for the transit in October. And therefore, it's a high moment for Russia to show that it is a reliable supplier to Europe.
And if we look at prices across the continent at the moment, why are the UK's gas and electricity prices the highest?
The UK situation is particularly difficult in this moment for a number of different factors. First, 50% of the electricity in the UK is generated with gas, and therefore the system is particularly attentive to what happens in the gas prices. Second, the aging fleet of nuclear power plants in the UK had a series of unplanned outages due to the need of providing maintenance that was not foreseen, adding pressure on gas demand for electricity generation. Third, an electricity interconnector supplying electricity from France to the UK got on fire and therefore was interrupted. So all these factors added to the fact that the wind speeds in the UK have been the lowest this season since the 1960s made the situation particularly difficult in the country.
So how should governments protect their citizens from higher energy prices? How long can they do that for? And how is this going to affect poorer nations in particular?
First of all, we need to take into consideration one fact. This is a temporary crisis. If you look at the market, and if you look at future, for example, at the Dutch gas hub, which is the most important in Europe, you will see that traders today think that after the winter, so in the spring 2022, prices will go down to the normal levels. So here we have an issue with the coming 4, 5, 6 months. How do we handle the winter? That's the question. What countries, what governments can and should do is to put in place mechanisms to protect the most vulnerable citizens and small medium enterprises for this price shock. This is what, for example, France has been doing, extending the regime of energy vouchers. This is what Italy now is doing by cutting certain costs in the electricity and gas bills for customers, families, and small medium enterprises. And this is what other countries are also doing. It is important at this point to protect the most vulnerable, to protect small medium enterprises, but then not to interfere in the market mechanism, because the market will keep working properly afterwards. So this is the best way to handle the crisis. The long-term fix for this situation is different, is to scale up investments and the rolling out of renewable energy sources and energy efficiency solutions.
Simone, it's been great to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you so much.
A community in Ecuador has been trying to resist the advance of mining companies. Residents from La Merced in Buenos Aires are pushing for it to be stopped, but the country's cash-strapped government is backing the firms, as Teresa Bo reports.
La Merced de Buenos Aires is a small parish in the middle of the Andes Mountains in Ecuador. Residents here have been struggling to defend their community from mining and the damage it causes for years. Now they're opposing the entry of a subsidiary of the Australian company Hancock Prospecting, a firm that has 6 mining concessions in the area to extract copper. Police were recently deployed to the area to protect their operations. They used tear gas and violence to control a peaceful protest. Zulema Armas is a parish leader. She says she has lost hope because no one is helping them in the fight to protect their community.
Buenos Aires has lost all hope. There is no government, no law, and it hurts. We want peace, and I'm traumatized. We thought the police there was sent to respect us because there were women, old people, but it was the contrary. The police is not for us, for the poor, for rural communities. The police is for the rich.
The people of La Merced de Buenos Aires say they know what mining can do to their territory. 4 years ago, they resisted when at least 10,000 illegal miners invaded the mountains in search of gold and filled the water with mercury and cyanide and left a trail of irreversible environmental damage. The crisis forced the government to declare a state of emergency. But now, with established companies trying to legally enter the territory again, Franklin Romero is concerned.
Para nosotros, las montañas...
For us, the mountains, the water is everything, is our mother, is how we can survive. The government is giving all the facilities for the company to come here and destroy the area. Nobody asked us whether we want this.
The government concession to the company is questioned by a report by the Controller General of the state. Environmental groups say Ecuador's constitution is being violated.
The state is violating the rights of the people to guarantee the work of transnational companies. The state has failed in the past because of the illegal mining crisis. Now they want to bring legal mining, but they are doing it with no previous consultation, as the constitution demands.
President Guillermo Lasso has created an action plan to promote legal mining and is hoping to exploit over 2.9 million hectares in the country. Ecuador's mining chamber says dialogue is the only way out of the crisis.
Yo creo que no existe.
There is no industry in the world that is born without those first pains. I believe the future of the country is in mining. I believe we have to care for the environment, but we also need minerals. The best way to stop illegal mining is to promote legal and responsible mining.
But in La Merced de Buenos Aires, people are afraid. They believe their territory will be destroyed, and their interests will be ignored once again. Teresa Bo, Al Jazeera.
Now, in the fast-moving world of cryptocurrency, it may surprise you to learn that the fastest take-up is in emerging economies. And we're not talking about speculation here, but for everyday transactions and savings. These are the top 20 adopters of cryptocurrency, according to Chainalysis. It's an interesting study because it strips out trading and speculation. And as you can see, Vietnam tops the ranking, with India and Pakistan rounding out the top three. And Afghanistan is propping up the table. Seventh on that list is Venezuela. That's because the local currency has been made effectively worthless by hyperinflation. Now the government has come up with a plan to try to fix it. Here's our Latin America editor, Lucia Newman.
Just like you can't judge a book by its cover, you can't calculate the value of Venezuela's currency by the number of zeros that are added or subtracted. As of October 1st, this 100 Bolivar note will be the highest denomination, equivalent to today's 100 million Bolivar note. That means six zeros will be removed from a currency that has been so devalued by hyperinflation that it's become practically worthless.
This is only for the bus fare. The bolivars now are only useful for public transport, nothing else. Everything else is paid with US dollars.
Venezuela's currency costs much more to make than what it's worth. Inflation in the first 4 months of this year was nearly 300%, and last year it was 3,000%. That's why the country's de facto currency has become the US dollar. But millions of Venezuelans don't have access to it. By slashing six zeros off its currency, the government hopes to reinstate the widespread use of its own coin.
It has certain advantages, but these advantages don't generate benefits from a strictly economic point of view. That would require a series of measures to control inflation to avoid more reconversions of the currency.
The socialist government slashed three zeros from its currency in 2008 and five zeros in 2018. So Teohildo Gil is not optimistic that six will do the trick.
This is going to become what it's already become, as all the currencies here have become. They have all become worthless like this.
Venezuela has been experiencing its worst economic crisis in history. Reducing bills to single, double, or triple-digit denominations rather than millions will certainly make prices easier to calculate. But unfortunately, it won't make the embattled Bolivar more valuable. Lucia Newman, Al Jazeera.
Well, Venezuela's central bank says that it plans to print the new bills that will go into circulation on October 1st, while encouraging Venezuelans to use a digital version of the currency to simplify daily transactions. The currency will be branded the Bolivar Digital. Now, the first to integrate Bitcoin as legal tender was El Salvador. The plan has been criticized by the International Monetary Fund because the volatile cryptocurrency could further undermine the country's stability. But enthusiasts argue that many people prefer to use crypto due to the low transaction costs of sending money overseas, like remittances. It's highly unlikely that other countries will follow El Salvador's lead. Cryptocurrencies are not the same as regular currencies, but some countries are making the transition to e-currencies. The Bahamas was the first to introduce its own sand dollar, and China is trialling its own e-currency. Beijing, along with many other countries, is clamping down on Bitcoin trading. The fear is that they would lose control over monetary policy if cryptocurrencies are adopted widely. Many advanced economies are trying to accommodate Bitcoin and thousands of other tokens rather than banning them. Well, despite a ban in February on cryptocurrency trading in Nigeria, transactions across peer-to-peer platforms have soared from $33 million to $44 million in August. To counter that, Nigeria's central bank has decided to launch its own digital currency, the Naira, later this year. Well, let's get some more analysis on Nigeria's decision to launch its own e-currency. Joining us from Lagos is Abayomi Michael, Chief Executive of the Asset and Equity Group. Good to have you with us on Counting the Cost, Abayomi. Why has there been such a strong take-up of cryptocurrencies in emerging markets in particular compared to established markets?
Nigeria is leading in terms of adoption for crypto, but then the edict that the regulators have regarding crypto generally is the control, okay? Regulators want to regulate. But then crypto does not really have so much ways around regulation. So, you know, it's more of a cat and dog kind of situation. So it's put on hold right now, not like it's entirely out of the market or not that it's entirely not in use at all in Nigeria, but people still more or less find their way around using crypto. But then officially, it's put on hold right now.
So Nigeria, it plans to launch its own e-currency. How do they differ from electronic payments that we're currently making?
It's going to be the Naira minted by the Central Bank of Nigeria directly. So the major difference between the e-Naira today and the electronic payment system that we already have in the country is that the wallet system that powers the e-Naira will be managed directly by the Central Bank of Nigeria. So the Central Bank will be in charge of producing, minting, and distribution of e-Naira, as against situation where most payment systems are managed, controlled, and more or less monitored by licensed payment system switches or operators within the Nigerian economy.
And do you think the people of Nigeria will actually embrace e-Naira as their means of savings and transactions, or are they just going to continue to use decentralized cryptocurrencies?
Why do people love decentralized currency in the first place? So people have shown or have demonstrated to be much more interested in anonymity, in less disclosure, not having to go through too much verification or too much restrictions as to when payment is to be initiated. So I see a little bit of some level of reluctance in user adoption. But then it's the government, and when the government puts something to law, you know, it's the law. And, you know, I listened to one of the directors of payments at the CBN recently at a conference saying it will be mandatory for anyone to accept the e-Naira, because the e-Naira is just as much as your normal traditional Naira notes. There will still be some level of resistance, because people don't want to disclose so much. People want some form of liberty when it comes to international transactions, offshore remittances, and the rest of it.
And if the country has to devalue its currency again at some point in the future, presumably that would impact the e-currency too.
Whatever happens at the international market to Naira, we'll definitely have some ripple effect on the normal e-Naira or whatever currency we choose to use, whether we change it in the future or not, it is still going to have the same impact across board.
And what impact would the use of an e-currency have on the financial sector of an economy?
The electronic currency definitely will bring down cost within the financial system. Of course, because the cost of printing money is also a cost. And the cost of, you know, managing distribution and, of course, transportation of cash, all these are costs associated with money, which, when eliminated or which when reduced, of course, will transfer or will translate to a reduction in major cost to users or, say, customers of banks and other financial institutions. So, generally, cost comes down, security is strengthened, and, of course, there are other cross-border benefits that, you know, e-currency might have on the financial system. For instance, Nigeria is leading the game in e-currency right now. Nigeria will be the first African country to issue the e-currency. I believe very soon Ghana is going to issue theirs. So I believe if Ghana has their e-currency and Nigeria has e-currency, it will be easier for a Nigerian to trade with a Ghanaian.
Abayomi, it's been great to talk to you. Many thanks indeed for being with us on Counting the Cost.
All right, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything that you've seen, you can get in touch with us. You can tweet me. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Please use the hashtag AJCTC. Or drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our webpage, and there you'll find entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.